This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, January 13th, 2013. I'm Caleb Brown. Kids who are unnecessarily disruptive in school ought to be punished. A new Department of Justice guidance on school discipline suggests that many otherwise minor matters of student discipline will become the cause for federal investigations under the guise of what's known as disparate impact. Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, explains.
The zero tolerance policies have been around now for years and quite rightly have provoked quite an outcry from all across the political spectrum for their irrationality, their zaniness, and we'll get to the incentives for why schools would adopt a policy as silly as that, I think a little bit later when we talk about this, but let's start by saying that libertarians certainly have been leading the charge on some of the problems with school discipline. Zero tolerance is one. Police intervention in areas where it would have been resolved by school officials or school district people. Truancy, for example. Why in some parts of the country do they run around treating truancy as a matter for arresting people? Why do many things that would have been resolved with suspensions or some other discipline suddenly turn into police referrals? So there's a lot that needs reconsideration. And when Attorney General Eric Holder and Education Secretary Arne Duncan got up to announce the new federal policies, they did strike some chords that we could see, yes, you know, this has gone way too far and it's time to reconsider them. If only we could stay on those points of agreement. But unfortunately, the policies that they unveiled open up a whole bunch of new problems where it's important we understand what they're trying to do because they will take us down some the dangerous paths of their own.
Disparate impact analysis is pretty broadly used in a lot of areas of federal regulation. But what does it mean here?
Well, disparate impact is familiar from employment discrimination, and that's the place where the courts have given it the thumbs up most clearly. When you turn to other types of discrimination, housing, education, voting, and various others, you find a much more ambiguous attitude. And in fact, one of the issues here is that it's not at all clear that the courts will take the same view on disparate impact when it gets there. But let's back up. What is disparate impact? The idea is even if there is no discriminatory intent, even if a school is in fact treating majority or minority kids on exactly the same basis when one of them breaks a rule, disparate impact says that the rule itself needs to be examined if it is leading to disproportionate amounts of discipline for one racial or ethnic group, for special ed kids as opposed to non-special ed kids. And it goes through a process, and again, those who have seen its equivalent in areas like employment discrimination will recognize this. The school has to defend the need for the rule. It has to serve an important educational purpose. If it's only serving a trivial education purpose, it might lose without even going any further. And who knows how that will play out on things like dress codes, for example. It may be, and this is one of the examples the federal guidance cites, you know, some ethnic groups may break dress codes more often because of their own habits of how to dress. That will be a disparate impact case right there if you try to enforce it through discipline. So they will examine, is it an important educational objective? And then even if it is, even if they admit that it's an important educational objective, they will go on and say, is there some other way that you could have arranged your rules to try to get this objective met without disciplining so many students from the wrong group? And that's going to be hard. It's much easier if you were a school bureaucrat to say, look, let's not go through this ordeal. Let's either get the numbers right and make sure that suspensions don't get too far out of line for any protected group, or else just figure out some other way of pleasing the inspectors from Washington, because one way or another, they will make the process difficult and expensive if once they start an investigation.
Boys are more likely to act up than girls?
Well, they are, and it's funny that you mentioned that because that's one of the greatest and most durable differences of all. And yet I read through the guidance, I read through the Dear Colleague letter, and I can't see that they spent any time at all on the fact that boys get disciplined much more than girls. You would think that it would have them just as upset. You would think that they would be demanding that girls be given a tougher look to find more ways to discipline them or something. But they skip right over that. The two areas that they spend time on, overwhelmingly, it's on racial disparities. They also mention, which is very interesting, disparities on special ed. And that is significant because in the categorization of who gets into special ed, you know, anyone who's been around a school realizes it's not blind and deaf kids and kids in wheelchairs. It's overwhelmingly kids who have emotional, behavioral, psychological differences, and very often they have gotten categorized as special ed because of things that correlate with acting out or being discipline problems. So it's not that surprising that the special ed kids get arrested and suspended at roughly twice the rate it differs, depending on the details. And they're saying that this needs to be rectified. Well, it's so strange. The whole point of getting the classification often was that the kid was acting out and they're trying to get special recognition that the kid needs different treatment. But the idea that they then can't be suspended at any greater rate even though they're misbehaving, it's just strange. Behind this all is the question, in general, do different groups, protected or otherwise, misbehave at different rates? On the boy-girl thing, hardly anyone thinks that girls are doing just as much misbehavior but somehow getting away with it. The fact is that boys misbehave more, and I say that as a boy. So the question that you would think they would have to put front and center is, you know, what about actual differences in misbehavior rates? And the mention of that is very brief and very brushing and just says basically we're not buying the idea that there are differential misbehavior rates. And of course, if they refuse to accept any evidence on that, then they're going to have a lot of investigations to do.
What should we expect this guidance to lead to down the road in terms of investigations, in terms of impact on schools and local administrators' ability to do what they're supposed to do?
It's a clear shot across the bow saying expect to be investigated if your numbers are too far off from even discipline. Those investigations may sometimes be generated by Washington itself, which may be going after bigger systems or going after whole states or cities as an example. They are also very often generated by complaints from particular parents whose own kid was disciplined or a group of parents saying, come over here, our kids have gotten and one of the examples the federal government guidance uses is two kids get in a fight. One of them gets a 3-day suspension. One of them gets a 2-day suspension. They said, when we investigate, we will expect the school to be able to provide written rationales for why one kid got a 3-day and the other kid got a 2-day suspension. And otherwise, we will find them to have discriminated. Now, if they're looking at things as small as that, as the difference between a 2-day and a 3-day suspension, then essentially everyone's going to be under the microscope. The idea of a de minimis rule of only big, serious types of departures from the intended goal. They really believe that they can come in and look at even very minute things and roll out major remedies for them.
What is driving this? Why is this a federal issue?
Well, why is this a federal issue? They will say, we have a responsibility to enforce the discrimination laws, and they tie it all back to the fact that as a condition of receiving federal funds, all these schools promise not to discriminate. At some ultimate level, so the federal government under the Constitution is not given any responsibility for education at all. That would seem to guide us toward a presumption that as a state and local activity, traditionally throughout American history, the primary responsibility, with perhaps an occasional exception as when the South had to be remediated, the occasional egregious misbehavior might somehow call down Washington, but the idea that Washington is to be a presence more or less all the time for everyone, looking over everyone's shoulder, it turns on its head the presumption that education is local. We wake up and we find that these laws have become an excuse for the federal government to do a complete takeover of this area. So that's at odds with the Constitution as far as I can see. Beyond that, they are imposing their own very dubious reading of what anti-discrimination means, because one of the questions almost anyone would think, reading through the Dear Colleague letter, is, all right, what about reverse discrimination? You've got these schools feeling under the gun if they don't turn in the right numbers. You've got plenty of anecdotal information indicating that they are sometimes tougher on the majority group or on the group that is under-disciplined and hand down longer suspensions just because they're afraid of making their numbers worse. What's the status of reverse discrimination? And there's this complete silence, as if they didn't view that as a danger worth warning about. But the laws themselves are neutral. The laws themselves say you can't discriminate in either direction. And I would think the federal government, in good faith, should take the same view.
Walter Olson is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He blogs at overlawyered.com and cato.org.